Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by the second annual Catskill Cuisine Festival. Visit catskill-cuisine.com to learn more and buy tickets.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce.
Today, I'm talking to Ethan Frisch and Ori Zohar, co-founders of Burlap and Barrel, the spice company deeply beloved by the chef community and home cooks in search of spices that taste like they're meant to taste. By connecting smallholder farmers to high-value markets, educating consumers, and sourcing unique spices using traditional sustainable techniques, Burlap and Barrel is building new international spice supply chains that are equitable, transparent, and traceable. Hi, Ethan. I'm good. Hi, Ori.
Hello, hello. Good to be here.
I'm thrilled to have both of you. Okay, so we're doing this a little early because a couple of us have seders tonight, and just in the holiday spirit, because you are, spice people, I just want to hear if there's anything I should be putting on my brisket, if there's anything that you either one of you made or Ethan, like any particular spice that, I'm going to regret not using.
I did my family Seder a day ahead of schedule, I guess in classic mm-hmm. Jewish fashion, form the holiday to meet your own requirements. So it was a Sunday. We all got together for a Seder on a Sunday, way more convenient than a Monday. And we made a few things. My father made a goulash, a beef goulash. Mm. So mm-hmm. a delicious classic dish, great way to use some excellent paprika. And then mm-hmm. we made a couple of roast chickens. That we rubbed with a whole bunch of spices, kind of whatever my grandmother, this is in my grandmother's kitchen. I keep her kitchen very well stocked with Burlap and Barrel spices.
Sure.
And so I put together a little rub with herbs de Provence and paprika, smoked paprika and turmeric, kind of a golden, smoky, herby roast chicken.
Yummy.
And it came out pretty good.
Great. I'll be back next week with another episode sauce. I feel like that's all I'm like salivating now. And now we have to talk about business things. And all I want to do is go see if I have smoked paprika. Okay. So we are going to talk about the business. I've been a fan. I've been a customer. We had them at the cooking school. Ethan, I feel like I've known you forever. Or at least since this whole weird CPG world happened to both of us. But, I didn't know some of the stuff, and I did watch the Shark Tank episode that you all were on, which I think everyone should watch. It was great. You were great. And what I didn't realize is like your first year was 100,000 in sales. Your second year was 200, then 600. And then I think you said it was like 3 million. In 2020 during the pandemic. Is that the trajectory that it was? I mean, that was nutso.
Yeah. Yeah. It was totally crazy. I mean, I think like when the business started, it was really like Ethan was not only packing and shipping spices in his apartment, but also going door to door to restaurants doing sales. And so that's, like that early on, that really, like, food service and restaurants was really helped really legitimize us. When a chef would say, hey, I choose burlap and barrel spices, it's like an athlete endorsing, like, your shoes, you know? But then the pandemic hit, and really quickly, half of our revenue at that point in 2019 came from restaurants, and that went very quickly to zero. And we were like, oh my God, we're gonna run out of business. Right. And then very quickly by May, home cooks more than made up for what we had lost from restaurants. And by the end of the year, our e-commerce grew 10x as, like, people that were cooking at home all of a sudden were buying, sure, first toilet paper, but then they were buying, you know, making banana bread, and we saw our cinnamon sales go up, buying beans. Like first the food came, and then they're like, I have to make this taste good. I have to make this taste like it would, if as if I were going out to eat out more. And all of a sudden we saw this kind of, like, second food wave from the pandemic, which first was the essentials. The second for us was the spices. And so all of a sudden e-commerce really started blowing up, and we shifted to being a primarily e-commerce business in that moment. And so we had this really crazy, unexpected acceleration. We started repacking food service sizes into jars. We set up a domestic supply chain because that's what we could get in. But really, like, 2020, the challenge was, can we, you know, instead of running out of business, which we thought at the beginning of the year, it was like, can we not run out of spices? Because what we learned is that people are giving us a chance, and we're either going to have that, the spices in stock and ready for them. And then 2021 was, again, another big growth year because everyone's supply chains were collapsing. But guess what? We actually have an expertise in supply chain because we built all these global supply chains for spices from all over the world. And so, again, we saw that we had a competitive advantage because we were able to stay in stock. And then as grocery stores started opening back up again, we were like, we need to really be above and beyond from product selection, from customer service, from shipping speed, from the way that it's packed, from all this stuff, to make sure that you say, hey, actually, now that I've tried ordering these single origin spices,
I don't need to buy, like, the 16-month-old cinnamon that's, like, gray at the supermarket.
Yeah, it wasn't a temporary, like, fix. It actually ended up being an upgrade to people's cooking and to people's pantries.
So basically, there are, like, 75 questions that one paragraph just triggered in me. And I want to start with, you know, I had Amy from Sum on, and she had a similar, you know, there are not that many brands that I know now that are as chef-driven, chef-beloved, right? And it's generally commodities that someone has figured out a way to make really in the best quality possible, a la spices or, in, you know, in her case, tahini. Chefs are comfortable using your spice as opposed to, like, they wouldn't necessarily use someone's condiment because they want to make their own and things like that. So I guess question number one is, was the plan before COVID, basically, that's a really good business, be primarily food service to all of these restaurants everywhere. It's bigger orders. It's easier communication. Were you thinking before COVID about sort of this D2C boom and, you know, email marketing and SEO optimization and all of that fun stuff? Or were you really planning on sticking kind of food service at that time?
I think from the get-go, we knew that there were always going to be two sides to this business. One, the sourcing side, can we bring in really high quality spices that people actually want to use? But then the other side is the education side, the sort of consumer education work that we do to help people understand what spices are and where they come from. Cinnamon is tree bark and black pepper is a berry that grows on a climbing vine. You know, these are ingredients people use every day and they don't know anything about them. And so that was always a goal of ours. And e-commerce was always a path to that goal. We had already been written up in the New York Times and Bon Appetit and other places as an e-commerce destination for spices before COVID, which was also one of the reasons we were able to respond as quickly as we did. You know, we were 3 years in, we had a business with infrastructure and inventory. And so when the demand hit, we were able
Got it. And then going back to Ori, what you were saying earlier about having to ramp up when something, you might have had it built. That's, I mean, great. I mean, for example, we did not. We had no e-com business. We were, you know, I mean, all of a sudden we started a Shopify thing and we had to get a 3PL and we had to get warehousing and we had to figure out refrigerated shipping. It was really only through COVID, just because we were refrigerated, we were heavier. Like, spices make so much more sense for an e-com business than we did. But it definitely was like a massive learning curve. But in your case, like you said, it was already set up. But even then, with a 10x growth over a couple of months during a global pandemic, like what did you have to, like, what was priority 1, 2, and 3 to catch up to that new reality of food service just being decimated and all of a sudden your e-com business exploding?
Well, I can share that. Like, it was a really stressful moment in the business. I think what a lot of people don't appreciate about food businesses, where you have to keep inventory and plan it all out, is the faster we grow, the more money we have to spend, because we have to buy the spices before. We make commitments to farmers during harvest, often even when they're planting the seeds. So all of a sudden, high growth means that we need a lot more money into the business. And so we were really just on this like really sensitive balance of every time we got paid for stuff, we would put 100% of that money back into ordering more spices, jars, labels, lids, and everything else. Mm-hmm. And so we had to really work hard to kind of be clever and shift the business into that. As Ethan mentioned, we had already been ready for e-commerce in that, like, we've been building it, but customer acquisition is expensive. We're a bootstrapped company. We're a social enterprise. So we didn't have access to investors or venture capital or anything like that. So we were like, how can we be clever about this? And so we had set up a spice forum on Facebook where we had people, our customers, talking to each other and sharing recipes and sharing how to cook with the spices and giving each other recommendations to take the load off of customer support, but also to just build a really nice community. And, you know, we were, I think, we had a few thousand members in that community, and now we're at around 12,000. We kept launching new and interesting spices. We had never done domestic spices. So we started sourcing salt from upstate New York. We started sourcing chilies from California. We started sourcing dried wild ramps from upstate New York. So we tried to be really clever on stuff that we could kind of bring in and quickly put into jars and get out to the customers. And even if we were sold out of something, we should be like, don't look over here at this thing that we're sold out of. Look over here at this brand new thing that we just launched. After that, we launched our Spice Club, which was our seasonal spice subscription. And so, like, we just tried to keep being like kind of crafty on things to keep customers' attention and to keep this going. But really, the first order of business was, don't sell out no matter what. Like, we just had to keep the inventory in stock, because what we learned is that if you're coming in to buy cinnamon and we're like, sorry, it's sold out, you're going to buy cinnamon somewhere else. Yeah, and you're not going to be like, well, let me wait 3 months to wait until their new harvest comes in. And so we really did everything that we could to just keep cinnamon and our main spices in stock. And we literally put spices on airplanes, you know, instead of most of the time things are brought in on boats.
Right.
We put spices on airplanes, which cost so much more, but we're like, we'll take it even if it's at break even, just to stay in stock, because these customers aren't, they're going to like figure out their allegiances to the new spice company, you know. And in this moment, there's a rare change of behavior. And so either we're going to be there or we're not going to be there. And we saw a lot of people kind of selling out of stock and being stuck and all this and that. But ultimately, people are looking for something, make their decision. And so that was the biggest thing for us. So we were spending all day and all night sourcing jars. This jar is sold out. Okay, let's bring in this jar. This spice is sold out. Let's bring in a backup from here. So we were really working our whole supply chain around the clock just to try to feel abundant and feel stocked and let people know that we're here for them and that we're going to help make sure that their boring meals get kicked up a little bit and they have brand new seasonings and new recipes.
And it's so, I remember that time really vividly. I think two things that you said from a business perspective are really interesting. And then there's a couple of other things from like sort of the more marketing perspective. But one is that, you know, that's why this time in our industry is so strange, because everyone is kind of going after these two competing goals. One is profitability, the other one is growth. And to your point, it's very hard to get the growth without spending the cash. Like, we live in a weird sales cycle business where we don't get paid. I mean, you get paid quicker when you're selling directly, but for those of us that are basically making inventory, storing it, selling it, and then eventually getting, you know, paid, hopefully, you need cash up front. So that's a really good point, I think, for people to hear. And then the second point that I really want to hammer home is I remember that time. And I remember during COVID, there were the companies that were like almost bickering with consumers. I don't know if you remember this, but they'd be like, give us a chance. We're a small business. You know, you're used to big businesses. We're, you know, we might not be there for the holidays, but that's not our fault. You know, like blame FedEx. Like, and I remember saying to my team, like, I don't think that's going to work. Like, I don't think that you can assume that consumers want what you have so much. And it goes back to like, is the customer always right? Of course not. Like, of course, sometimes they're super douchey. But for the most part, to your point, you know, they are making a decision right now. They're never coming back if you don't capture them. And that's just the reality. What you might be compelling. You might be the freshest, the best. You might have the best social mission. You might all of those things. But if you lose them when they want that cinnamon, they're not coming back to you the next time they want it because they've either gotten it somewhere else and they don't need cinnamon for another 6 months and they've forgotten about you. Or to your point, they've kind of built an allegiance to another company. And I think it was like there were these go-go years where brands kind of forgot that. And I think you didn't forget that, which clearly sort of saved you during that time. That's really good. I want to go now, Ethan, I think this is more in your camp because I'm thinking about that time and I'm thinking, you know, I'm not going to the grocery store as much. I am baking all of this, you know, banana bread and making oatmeal and learning how to, you know, channel my inner home cook at home. Where I think you guys see an opportunity aside from creating a more equitable, more traceable supply chain than let's say some of like the bigger spice conglomerates in the world is the grocery store brands don't necessarily have the spice club and the spice forum. And here are all these recipes. And here's a story about this berry that is now dried and will add this certain flavor to your food. And like that, I guess that, I mean, in part, that's why this was, it was food service and D2C as opposed to food service and retail, because D2C really gave you the opportunity to build those connections and to build that community and to do the storytelling and all of that. Is that a safe assumption?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then tell me, I want to hear a little bit more about the Spice Forum and the Spice Club and, you know, it reminds me of like the Rancho Gordo, you know, bean club. I mean, people are crazy about beans. And it's this like, you know, private like channel on Facebook that you have to be accepted into. I think he has like 15,000 bean people on there. And I think that's what's so cool about Facebook, which, you know, I think we've tried in a couple of different ways to kind of like crack into, can we get some kind of a cooking club? But I think around spices or around these ingredients, these Facebook groups are really, really powerful. And there's none of the kind of nonsense of the look at my nails as I unbox this thing on TikTok kind of stuff. Like these are hardcore people. So I want to hear about the Spice Club. I want to hear about the forum. I want to hear what you've learned from those people, from that community, how you've kind of capitalized on the insights. Tell me more.
Yeah, great question. The Bean Club was definitely an inspiration for us in starting Spice Club. And Steve Sando mm-hmm. of Rancho Gordo was an early mentor. I had cold called mm-hmm. him, I think reached out early on, realizing that we had sort of a similar challenge of mm-hmm. selling a you know, a kind of a pantry staple, but doing it in a fun, exciting kind of e-commerce oriented way. So he mm-hmm. became a mentor, an advisor, and now a good friend. So the Bean Club was certainly our inspiration. But the other thing that it did for us was it gave us a kind of ready-made community. Anybody who was buying specialty beans on the internet, you know, also needed good spices and cared about where they came from and was cooking a lot at home. And so that's what we found kind of across the board, is that the culinary revolution is being led, not, like you said, not on TikTok, but by, you know, by middle-aged ladies cooking at home, you know, people who are preparing food on a regular basis, cooking from scratch, thinking about where their ingredients come from. That they have been our core customers from the very beginning. We've always had a high percentage of orders from AOL email addresses, which tells you a lot about who's placing those orders. So yeah, we met this community.
Like, was it a surprise to you who your consumer actually turned out to be?
You know, I think as an entrepreneur, you often start a company thinking you're serving yourself, right? Like that you're representative of the market that you're trying to reach. And we figured out pretty early on that actually there was a very different demographic who cared a lot and more, you know, more than our own demographic. I was, you know, we were in our late 20s, early 30s when we started the company, 2016. So, you know, it turned out that urbanites, you know, we lived in New York and San Francisco, and of our age group really were not buying spices online, and we're not paying that close attention to where their ingredients come from, even if we wish they did.
Even if they say that they are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But the serious home, you know, who are the serious home cooks in America? They're, you know, women 40 plus who are often cooking for family and make it a real passion. So,
and by the way, that's our community,
and we have embraced them wholeheartedly. Yeah. I mean, Ori, one thing that Ori sort of talked about in our COVID spike, we wound up hiring a whole bunch of our customers to help us with customer service and operations, and they're all still on the team. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 members of our team were direct to consumer customers, including all three of our customer support team. So
I love that.
That was great.
I mean, that's awesome. And, you know, by the way, I think I've said this on the podcast before, that demographic has fewer people vying for them. Although now that menopause is a thing, I guess more, but you know, still relatively little. 2, that demographic has more disposable income. And 3, that demographic makes something like 80% of the purchasing decisions in the American household. So good demographic to have. Okay, we're going to take a little break and we're going to come right back and we're going to go back to talking about Shark Tank because I have more questions. We'll be right back.
Gather your friends and family at the 2nd Annual Catskill Cuisine Festival presented by the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, Bethel Woods Center for the Arts, and Resorts World Catskills. Mark your calendars for a flavor-packed weekend from May 10th to May 12th. Experience the fusion of phenomenal food and electrifying entertainment. Rub shoulders with your favorite Food Network personalities, including Andrew Zimmern, Michael Simon, Scott Conant, Marcus Samuelson, Jeffrey Zakarian, Anne Burrell, Melba Wilson, and distinguished international chefs by LaBelle Farms. Kick off the festivities with Friday's star-studded golf tournament and evening reception. Saturday heats up with free tastings, thrilling live demos, music, and family activities, culminating with a gourmet dinner hosted by celebrity chefs. And on Sunday, celebrate Mother's Day with a special celebrity-curated brunch. Tickets for this celebration are selling like hotcakes. Visit Catskill-Cuisine.com to grab your pass for this unforgettable weekend in the picturesque Catskills. See you there.
I'm back with Ori and Ethan, co-founders of Burlap and Barrel. Okay, so back to Shark Tank. I think, you know, at this point now, I would say 6 out of 10 of my friends in this space have been on it or are going on it. With, you know, mixed results when it comes to the deal. I don't think anyone cares really about the deal. I don't know that anyone really remembers. It seems to me like, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's essentially an ad in a lot of ways where you get in front of millions of people and tell your story, and no one is judging you if Mr. Wonderful doesn't want to invest in your company or whatever. I think that, you know, when you have a click to buy sort of scenario, like there is an Amazon or a D2C, that makes a lot of sense for the more retail heavy businesses. I would imagine the lift would be different. I guess my questions are around how people or entrepreneurs or early stage founders should think about that ROI. How much time, money, resources are you investing? How much revenue and awareness do you sort of ascribe to the appearance? You know, I would imagine there's like a massive bump. And then how do you capture, you know, that's all sort of top of funnel stuff. How do you kind of get them to repeat? So lots of questions, but mostly I guess it's about how you think about it. And I mean, you had said it in your notes to me that you think everyone should try to get on. So clearly you have really good things to say.
Yeah. I mean, we chatted with maybe a dozen entrepreneurs, food entrepreneurs who had been on Shark Tank. And a lot of them said that, like, as long as the sharks kind of like your product and have a good review, that's a pretty strong endorsement. I think like as of last year, the average Shark Tank episode got like 4 million viewers the night it airs. And then I'm guessing another 4 million on Hulu afterwards like that. It's hard to tell exactly. But we really view this as like a chance to like, yes, it would be great if the sharks, you know, got the business, wanted to invest and kind of were be able to kind of bump up and up the valuation. But most of the time they do what they do. They're pretty sharky. But from what we heard from everyone is like, listen, you get to give a 2-minute uninterrupted ad on national television and people watch and people shop the show. And so that's what we did. We went on there. We prepared for months, everything from picking the spices to make sure that we had good inventory if it did eventually go to air, which not all of them do. We practiced our pitch, our 2-minute pitch. Then the sharks have producers in their ears throwing all kinds of questions at you. So we practiced every single variation.
You really knew your stuff too. Like what you also like Michelle Jimenez did the same thing where she was like, when for the pizza cupcake, when they offered her deal, she was like, well, how about this? I would be like a deer in frickin' headlights. I don't know. Okay. Like, thank you. And then I'd run out the door. Like you were so composed and you kept having, did you know that they were going to come back with those? Like, how did you have all the deals built in your head already? You were like prepared.
We planned them all out. We gamed out different scenarios. What would happen if this shark was in and that shark was out and who did we want to go with?
Gosh.
And how we played out every scenario we could imagine so that we were prepared. And we also, you know, had a little curveball for Mr. Wonderful that we threw in at the end, knowing that, you know, we were trying to up the drama a little bit and get ourselves a little more airtime. So if we had a deal for him, you know, we do a lot of royalties. So it's sort of it was a natural fit. And, you know, whether we got it or not, it was part of our strategy, the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, I was very impressed. You would have to give me like 6 Klonopin, literally. I was sweating watching you.
It was nerve wracking, but it was fun. We went through hair and makeup and wardrobe. We were in like the Sony studios in Los Angeles. Ethan had a brand new newborn kid. So I flew in like a week early and we spent day and night kind of rehearsing, but we knew that we had one shot and we filmed for maybe 45 minutes or an hour.
Yeah.
It's really hard to tell time in there. And then they cut it into 8 action packed minutes. And we viewed our job as like, how do we make good TV? How do we make it fun and entertaining and something that's worth watching? Because they keep cutting, you know, along the way, they don't air everyone that they film. And what ended up happening is when it aired, we watched our site and our site just exploded. And I think this is like goes back to the COVID conversation. We were either going to be in stock and ready to go at that moment that it aired. And they only give you a 3-week heads up when it airs. So that's not a lot of time, you know, Allie, to do new batches of product.
To build up your inventory. Yeah.
So we had bulk spices ready. We had labels ready. We had everything good to go so that we could pull the trigger on packing more spices, but we didn't have to in case it didn't air. So we were kind of like gamed it all out, like Ethan said. And then what ended up happening is we did end up going to air. And April 7th, 2023 was our biggest day of sales. And April 8th, 2023, the next day was our second biggest day of sales. Like there was just a massive response.
Yeah.
And not only was that really great, but we got ready with our fulfillment centers, with our co-packers, with, we made sure our site hosting was ready. We did so much work into it, but it paid off where a lot of new people found out about Burlap and Barrel. And then every single time they re-air it, we see a new bump in traffic. Yeah. So it's been really quite a gift. It ended up being this massive, massive PR thing. It would have been really nice to get a deal with the Sharks, but honestly, I think we won in the biggest way possible, you know? Because we were able to get this massive endorsement on national TV from the Sharks and Gwyneth Paltrow, no less.
Yes. Who, by the way, when she was like, I've never heard it of it, I'm like, well,
Reddit was upset with her about that, but now she posts about us in her stories all the time. So I feel like we're good now.
Amazing. I took a little exception to that. I can't decide, you know, I always like, I never name the episode until the interview. And so when Ethan said earlier, culinary revolution, I was like, ah, okay, we're going to call it building a culinary revolution. And then, but you keep going back to like being in stock. So I want to be like building always in
the
stock.
The very sexy, sexy term.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know which one yet. We'll see. We'll see. I'll let you know.
No, but just for what it's worth, just a lot of our worldview is just like, we spend so much time building these supply chains and sourcing the spices. We spend time on the farms. There's so much work that goes into like building it. And then just to then be out of stock because of a fulfillment hiccup or because FedEx is slow or because of whatever. So I think that's where Ethan and I have been just really careful, is to saying that like, we're going to source these incredible spices and tell these farmer stories and build these supply chains. And you're going to absolutely love the spice once it's in your home, but we're going to put just as much care into our customer support team of having really thoughtful people that love our spices and not outsource customer support. We're going to put so much effort into building a site that's intuitive and easy and welcoming and makes it easy for you to shop around. And we're going to make sure that it gets to you really quickly. And so we're really careful about doing both sides of the coins. And I think that there's a lot of entrepreneurs that they're really exceptional at one side of it. But what we've done is been able to kind of make sure that, okay, we're going to be on Shark Tank. We are going to make sure that we can fulfill over 1,000 orders on a Sunday. And we were able to do that.
Yeah. And then you have to make sure that you're re-engaging these folks when they come to the site to check it out and they decide not to purchase. Or when they do purchase and you want to make sure that they purchase again, like you're just making sure that you are not leaving any of that like beautiful, perfect paprika like on the counter. You are like using your finger and scooping it up and making sure that it like goes into the recipe. Okay. I get it. And I think that there's this massive, I mean, Bob's Red Mill to me is like the Daddy Mac and the Mac Daddy, right? Like you go there for recipes for bread baking, whether or not you've bought Bob's, you know, Red Mill flour. They have figured out the way to be this very wholesome resource for home bakers. They're sort of my guiding light in terms of like the kind of experience you want to create for people with your product. And when we talk about building community, yada, 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 what does it really mean? And I think that that is what it really means. That is what like McCormick, for example, has not done around their spices. But that is easier to do, as I know you guys know, online than it is in store. And now there are more tools to connect in store with online, but it seems like you're now starting to really adapt and think about grocery retail in a bigger way. And I'm kind of curious, like, what does that look like for you? You know, what are your expectations for that? I would imagine that, you know, the velocity isn't like super high in the spice set. Are you thinking about, you know, being the premium offering? Are you thinking about the single spices versus like a pizza blend? Or, you know, how are you thinking, I guess, about grocery?
Yeah. Yeah. And Allie, I mean, you have more experience in grocery than we do. So we also could use some advice and lessons from you. Maybe that's the next episode of Allie Tell Us What to Do in Grocery. But really for us, I think a lot of entrepreneurs go into grocery too early, because if you're going to go into grocery, you need a broker, you need a distributor, you need a merchandiser. How do you do that when you're still like paying a ton of money for your packaging and paying a ton of money for your packing, and you're not anywhere near at scale. So like, I think starting out in food service and then building up e-commerce, once we got to that point where we were like ordering our glass jars, you know, from the glass factory in Asia by the container, all of a sudden that started opening up enough margin. For us to be able to like, okay, now we can start going, and now we could pay a distributor, and now we can pay, because we can't afford to lose money because we're a bootstrapped company. And so everything we do has to be profitable. And that has kind of made us force some focus on us. So we can only do it if the numbers work. And so it took us 5 years maybe before we started really pursuing grocery, and we really started a bottoms up approach. Yeah. We started with small specialty independent. Fair really helped us get into a lot of new doors. And now we're starting to work with regional grocery stores and independent, you know, distributors and all that stuff. To be honest with you, we're quite scared of national because we just know how complicated it is and how many things you have to get right. I mean, we even saw there was a grocery store that's a major customer. A friend was there, said, "Hey, your spices are mostly out of stock." We're like, "Really?" And so we emailed them and they placed a $1,400 order to restock our spices, which was great. But we just know there's a whole art to grocery. Yeah.
But don't they know that the podcast is titled Always in Stock, Building Always in Stock? Exactly. That's your whole thing, Ori. That must have made you like throw up in your mouth. There's nothing worse than being told that you are out of stock on the shelf when you know that you have inventory and you know that just something has broken in the distribution channel. It is an infuriating business at times.
Yeah. From the outside, you're like, well, of course grocery stores would put you in a good place and merchandise you well and reorder when it's out of stock. But I think the reality is that margins have been a lot thinner for grocery stores. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of expecting brands to step in and do a lot more of the heavy lifting. And so that's why we waited a long time until we did grocery, because I think a lot of companies have gone out of business rolling out nationally somewhere and then getting cut 3 or 6 months later and then having to be stuck with a ton of inventory or not really knowing what to do. So that's been our strategy. We want to be slightly premium, but not special occasion. Like don't buy crappy turmeric that costs $2 a jar, you know, but we'll have really incredible turmeric that you're going to really love, that you can still use in your everyday cooking and doesn't feel like it's so precious that you need to kind of save it only for when you have guests over. It's a treat for yourself. So we've now been figuring that out. What about case size, packaging price, merchandising? So I think that's what we've been slowly dipping our toes into. And because e-commerce is really our like revenue engine where customers are, it does two things. One is we can kind of slowly build our way into grocery without it being this kind of do or die, which I think a lot of entrepreneurs are like, if I don't get this big order from Whole Foods, it's over for me. So we don't have that pressure on ourselves. And then number two is, instead of having to convince strangers on the shelves of a grocery store to know about our spices and to care about them, we have a bunch of e-commerce customers that know us and love us.
And if they see it, they'll pick it up.
Exactly. So that's been our kind of strategy, is to slowly and do it way later than most people think about it.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, it's interesting. I never really understood, I guess, the concept of channels until really recently, you know. And I think one of the things I love the most about this business after I just complained about it is like, there's a cap for every bottle, right? You are a shelf stable, dry, lightweight, although, you know, in glass product that makes a lot more sense when there is a story to tell and you're basically trying to explain why they should buy your cinnamon for XYZ more than what they're used to. It is a natural fit with that channel. And you know, I know you were kind of joking about the advice, but like the way that I would think about retail for you is basically an awareness channel. Like it's how we're kind of thinking about e-com for us in a lot of ways. Like our main revenue driver is going to be retail. We're going to be able to grow our like funnel and like the awareness of our brand and our products and what we have to offer to the consumer through storytelling, through Amazon and D2C to some extent. But we will always be primarily a retail channel. You might be the opposite, where you are primarily an e-com business, but you use these as like billboards in people's stores. And the more points where they see it in their journey, that's when like people talk about omnichannel, you know, it goes back to the consumer. The consumer, when they see you on that shelf, they might not buy you on that shelf, but they'll remember you and they'll be like, okay, this is now validated to me that this is a real brand and they're like a real thing. And, you know, next time I need my turmeric, I'll remember to go back and order it. Or to your point, oh, wow, I forgot. I might be low on whatever. And so I'll pick it up from them because I already know them. But I think it's interesting to think about them as different things. And when you think about them as different things, then all of a sudden you decide the priority for it. What is the margin that I need to have on this channel, right? Like what percentage of this channel is dedicated to marketing and what percentage of this channel is dedicated to sales? Now, even if it's dedicated to marketing, I'm not willing to lose money on it. But do I need a 30% contribution margin or is 15 okay, right? And then you're basically dividing each thing and deciding, all right, net net, if this is 80% of my business and it's, you know, a 15% contribution margin, that's probably not great. If it's 80% of my business and it's a 30, then okay, now we're kind of in business. You know, that type of decision making. But it took me a while to, I mean, first of all, because we were really a single channel business for until now, like now, like until yesterday, basically.
Yeah. And a lot of these companies also are like, oh, is it going to be a negative 15% contribution margin, you know, until like in the early years. But I have to say, like, we view grocery really as like higher volume, kind of, you need to pick up a jar of cinnamon, you need to pick up a spice blend. We have these great origin blends that we've been sourcing that we're pushing more and more into grocery. But online, I mean, Ethan's been heading up like an insane product development kind of lineup. We have so much cool new stuff online, from spice extracts to sugar, single origin sugars and single origin salts and wild vanillas that you could never get anywhere. And these things will never be a fit for grocery.
Right.
But online gets to be this kind of cool innovation, R&D, and also this much more specific channel where we have unlimited shelf space. And so that's where like there's an interplay between grocery and e-commerce, where each one does a different thing, but they both really complement each other. And we know that 95% of people buy spices at grocery. Yeah. So we want to be there. But as soon as you're ready to unlock the whole world of incredible spices, come to burlapandbarrel.com and you're going to be in for a treat.
Okay. I want to hear one more tidbit. So you told me about the insight from the Spice Club and the Spice Forum that, you know, your demographic and like maybe your, you know, who was buying your spices wasn't exactly who you intended it to be or who you thought it was going to be. But I want to hear any other insights that you got from those folks when it comes to innovation, let's say, Ethan, or when it comes to what they're looking for, that you were able to sort of gather from the insights and then act upon in the business?
Yeah. Like Ori mentioned, we do a lot of product development. We found that really supports our e-commerce business, brings people back to the site to check out the new things. And we do a lot of it through our Spice Club, which is, you know, 3,500 subscribers, a lot of those diehard fans, that demographic that we're talking about. And so they have become essentially our R&D pipeline, where we sort of soft launch a new product, a spice mustard or a jam or a snack or all kinds of fun stuff that we're working on with other companies. We soft launch it through Spice Club, get a ton of customer feedback from this diehard community. And then that drives the decisions that we make about that product going forward, whether we move it into a wider launch, change the packaging, don't launch it any wider than that. Maybe that's the end of it. But that's where Spice Club has been really useful.
Right.
And you know, the community that comes with it.
By the way, we're gonna make an LTO aioli. You're gonna tell me what it's gonna be. We're going to ask your people. We just got good news that like our minimums on pouch orders is like less than it was. So now we can actually do LTOs, and like, very exciting. So we are going to do that. Everyone who's listening, I want a DM from you. What flavor aioli? Do you want a mustard aioli? Do you guys have like good, like pickling spices? Cause we could do like a cool, like pickle vibe. I feel like you could just rattle off like 17 things that we could do.
Oh yeah, sure. Aioli is such a good vehicle for all kinds of different flavors. So
totally.
Yeah, go crazy. You know, we could come up with some fun ideas.
Go crazy, people. Okay. And then whoever wins gets, I don't know, a hug and a free
a lot of aioli.
Yes. And some spices. Okay. Last question on the show with this whole Mr. Wonderful thing, whatever him, but you were talking about royalty, influencers and chefs. You know, there's this thing out there. It's like, I've had a hard time defining it, but it's like the good old fashioned, don't have too much of a sales team, have your customers doing your sales for you, Tupperware, Avon, you know, that type of, I don't want to say MLM, but a little bit, right? Like the, it's not an illegal situation, but it's like, you know, word of mouth where those people are incentivized and paid, you know, for doing the work of a sales team, combined with today's sort of, you know, a lot of companies I know are finding ways to let influencers and content creators kind of design, in very loose, you know, quotations, their own product or make their own blend or make their own t-shirt, and it's theirs, and they feel this like pride of ownership, and they go on their social channels, and again, they're doing the marketing and they're doing the sales for the company. I don't want to imply that like it's not like a beautiful, real, wonderful thing, but I do think it's a really smart business thing for you to let chefs feel great about the fact that they have made something, and then they're going out and sort of doing the selling for you and getting paid a royalty for it. It's so good. How do you structure it? Do you go find them? Do they find you? How do those marketing channels work? And like, how can other founders and early stage companies kind of think about this as a way to market without, you know, so much of the spend that often comes with marketing? Like, it's a really cool way to get the word out to an audience that you would normally have to pay a lot for. Go.
Yeah. Thanks. Good question again. We do a lot of these. I'll just start by saying, you know, like 15 a year or something, we crank these out. Spice blends are a really effective vehicle for storytelling. You can talk about a family recipe. You can talk about a cultural icon. You can talk about a famous dish and do that through a spice blend, which gives somebody, you know, any home cook, doesn't have to be a professional, gives somebody the ability to recreate a really complex flavor and potentially a really challenging dish otherwise. Mm-hmm. So that's one side of it. Our product is just uniquely suited to tell those kinds of stories. Another side of it is that we're an online business, so we can launch new stuff. We can tell those stories. We can receive the new customers that those collaborators are sending our way, because that's a big reason to do it for us is, you know, we're getting in front of the audience of a particular chef or cookbook author or somebody else that we're collaborating with. And hopefully that person will also want to buy our cinnamon and cumin and other things that we carry. So that's a second element of it. And the third element of it is that it's just fun, you know, like it's a way to be creative and try new things and, you know, reach out into new cuisines that we don't know as well personally, with people who really have the expertise. So we learn a lot and experiment a lot and enjoy it, internally and externally, but really it all came from Floyd Cardoz. He was the late chef of Tabla and North End Grill and many other places. I had worked for him as a line cook at Tabla a long time ago, and he had gotten back in touch with me in 2018, 2019 about launching a line of spice blends, something he had always thought about doing. Mm-hmm. And we started working on it together. And then he passed away of COVID in March of 2020. Yeah. We saw him in India. We were there on a sourcing trip ourselves. And anyway, the whole trip got interrupted. Everything changed. But he came to us and said, make spice buns for me and pay me a royalty and I'll help you sell them. Wow. And we're like, that's a pretty good idea.
Yeah. So it's amazing.
We've kept doing it ever since. His wife, I talked to her this morning. We have a very close relationship. She manages his whole set of masalas, a whole business that she's built around his recipes and his legacy. And we've sold 60,000 jars of those masalas. Wow. Since we launched in 2020. It's pretty great. Yeah.
Yeah. No, amazing. I love it. I'm trying to think of how I can whip out aiolis. Like, you make an aioli and you make an aioli. Like, I just feel like everyone would make an aioli if they could. Like, everyone would make an aioli. You know, we can just put it in a pouch.
Yeah. If you do small batches, even, you know, like R&D quantities, we're not making tons of any of these collaborations. Mm-hmm. We work with our co-packer to produce them in manageable quantities. Mm-hmm. Based on what we think that person's going to sell, what kinds of volumes that person's going to sell. And we coordinate very closely with them. You know, it really is a relationship.
And
you know, they pay off over time. We have collaborators we've been working with, you know, Barca Cardos, as an example of that. We've been working very closely with her for, going on 5 years. So it's, they really work.
Very cool. Okay. Fun question, Ethan. Five spices, top five of all time on the website. Do the obvious ones first, and then the last couple, I want to guess. The five spices that are the most popular.
I saw this as a potential question. I just pulled up the numbers, and I think there's a couple that are surprising.
Okay, a couple of sleeper spices.
The number one is our royal cinnamon.
Yeah, I would guess that.
Number two is our purple striped garlic. And number three is the wild mountain cumin.
Okay. There's got that lime, that burnt lime situation.
The ground black lime is number six. Very good.
All right. I was close.
What else?
There's got to be a black pepper.
You know what? You would be surprised, but we actually end up selling more black pepper by the 1 pounder than we do. Okay. So it's there in quantity, but not in units. I'm talking in units moved.
Okay.
You mentioned one of the spices on this call. Number four is our smoked paprika.
Oh, paprika. Yeah, that makes sense.
And number five, I think, is interesting. We just wrote a whole newsletter about this, but number five is our za'atar, which is the first origin blend that we introduced, which was really about just trying to answer the question of a lot of people are buying spice blends. They don't want to buy a bunch of individual spices and blend them. They want them to be mixed. And so we said, what do we do with spices? Like, how do we offer that? And so our answer was, let's go to farmers that are growing spices and blending them according to their traditional recipes in ways that line up with their tradition and history and recipes. And so that was za'atar came in as our first origin blend.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. I have to say that, you know, I always go back to, I think people want it really simple and easy. And if you can put a blend together and tell them exactly what to do with it and where it goes, you're saving yourself and them a lot of work. So that doesn't really surprise me. I happen to love mustard seeds, but I don't think they're going to be in the top.
Is there anything else on your wish list? We're looking at some mustard seeds.
I love mustard seeds. I mean, I do. I love a really bright orange turmeric. I'm trying to think. I love black sesame seeds, by the way. And I feel like a lot of times they smell like a little damp, like something has happened along the way. So just FYI. All right. Well, guys, this was amazing. I'm hungry. I'm going to go make my brisket. And I really appreciate you coming on and sharing all of this, Ethan. Thank you.
Thanks for having us. This was great.
Thank you, Allie.
And Liam, as always, thank you for engineering and to Heritage Radio Network. I will be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce.
In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.